Hello and welcome to our programme. My name is Angus McVicar and I will be reading Time magazine here on Sight into Sound Radio. Our first article is titled Artificial Intelligence, by the people, for the people. The workers making artificial intelligence possible rarely see its rewards. One Indian startup is trying to do things differently. In the shade of a coconut palm, Chandrika tilts her smartphone screen to avoid the sun's glare. It is early morning in Alahalli village in the southern Indian state of Karnataka, but the heat and humidity are rising fast. As Chandrika scrolls, she clicks on several audio clips in succession, demonstrating the simplicity of the app she recently started using. At each tap, the sound of her voice speaking her mother tongue emerges through the phone. Before she started using this app, 30-year-old Chandrika, who like many southern Indians, uses the first letter of her father's name, K, instead of a last name, had just 184 rupees, $2.25, in her bank account. But in return for around 6 hours of work spread over several days in late April, she received 2,570 rupees, or $31.30. That's roughly the same amount she makes in a month of working as a teacher at a distant school, after the cost of the three buses it takes her to get there and back. Unlike her day job, the app doesn't make her wait until the end of the month for payment. Money lands in her bank account in just a few hours. Just by reading text aloud in her native language of Kannada, spoken by around 60 million people, mostly in central and southern India, Chandrika has used this app to earn an hourly wage of about $5, nearly 20 times the Indian minimum. And in a few days, more money will arrive, a 50% bonus, awarded once the voice clips are validated as accurate. Chandrika's voice can fetch this sum because of the boom in artificial intelligence, or AI. Right now, cutting-edge AIs, for example, large language models like ChatGPT, work best in languages like English, where text and audio data is abundant online. They work much less well in languages like Kannada, which even though it is spoken by millions, is scarce on the internet. Wikipedia has 6 million articles in English, for example, but only 30,000 in Kannada. When they function at all, AIs in these lower resource languages can be biased by assuming that doctors are men and nurses women, for example, and can struggle to understand local dialects. To create an effective English-speaking AI, it is enough to simply collect data from where it has already accumulated. But for languages like Kannada, you need to go out and find more. This has created huge demand for datasets, collections of text or voice data, in languages spoken by some of the poorest people in the world. Part of that demand comes from tech companies seeking to build out AI tools. Another big chunk comes from academia and governments, especially in India, where English and Hindi have long held outsized precedence in a nation of some 1.4 billion people, with 22 official languages and at least 780 more indigenous ones. This rising demand means that hundreds of millions of Indians suddenly possess a scarce and newly valuable asset, their mother tongue. Data work creating or refining the raw material at the heart of AI is not new in India. The economy that did so much to turn call centres and garment factories into engines of productivity in the late 20th century has quietly been doing the same with data work in the 21st. And like its predecessors, the industry is once again dominated by labour arbitrage companies, which pay wages close to the legal minimum, while selling data to foreign clients for a hefty markup. The AI data sector, worth over $2 billion globally in 2022, is projected to rise to $17 billion by 2030. Little of that money has flowed down to data workers in India, Kenya, and the Philippines. These conditions may cause harms far beyond the lives of individual workers. We're talking about systems that are impacting our whole society, and workers who make those systems more reliable and less biased, says Jonas Valenti, an expert in digital work platforms at Oxford University's Internet Institute. If you have workers with basic rights who are more empowered, I believe that the outcome, the technological system, will have a better quality as well. In the neighbouring villages of Alahalli and Chilakavadi, one Indian startup is testing a new model. Chandrika works for Karaya, a non-profit launched in 2021 in Bengaluru, formerly Bangalore, that bills itself as the world's first ethical data company. Like its competitors, it sells data to big tech companies and other clients at the market rate. But instead of keeping that much cash as profit, it covers its costs and funnels the rest toward the rural poor in India. In addition to its $5 hourly minimum, Karaya gives workers de facto ownership of the data they create on the job. So whenever it is resold, the workers receive the proceeds on top of their past wages. It's a model that doesn't exist anywhere else in the industry. The wages that exist right now are a failure of the market, Manu Chopra, the 27-year-old CEO of Karaya, tells me. We decided to be a non-profit because fundamentally, you can't solve a market failure in the market. The work Karaya is doing also means that millions of people whose languages are marginalized online could stand to gain better access to the benefits of technology, including AI. Most people in the villages don't know English, says Vinutha, a 23-year-old student who used Karaya to reduce her financial reliance on her parents. If a computer could understand Kannada, that would be very helpful. The catch, if you can call it that, is that the work is supplementary. The first thing Karaya tells its workers is, this is not a permanent job, but rather a way to quickly get an income boost that will allow you to go on and do other things. The maximum a worker can earn through the app is the equivalent of $1,500, roughly the average annual income in India. After that point, they make way for somebody else. Karaya says it has paid out 65 million rupees, nearly $800,000, in wages to some 30,000 rural Indians up and down the country. By 2030, Chopra wants to reach 100 million people. I genuinely feel this is the quickest way to move millions of people out of poverty if done right, says Chopra, who was born into poverty himself. This is absolutely a social project. Wealth is power, and we want to redistribute wealth to the communities who have been left behind. Chopra isn't the first tech founder to rhapsodize about the potential of artificial intelligence data work to benefit the world's poorest. Sama, an outsourcing company that has handled contracts for OpenAI's ChatGPT and Meta's Facebook, also marketed itself as an ethical way for tech companies to lift people in the global south out of poverty. But as I reported in January, many of its ChatGPT workers in Kenya, some earning less than $2 per hour, told me they were exposed to training data that left them traumatized. The company also performed similar content moderation work for Facebook. One worker on that project told me he was fired when he campaigned for better working conditions. When asked by the BBC in 2018 about low wages, Sama's late founder argued that paying workers higher wages could disrupt local economies, causing more harm than good. Many of the data workers I've spoken to while covering this industry for the past 18 months have bristled at this logic, saying it's a convenient narrative for companies getting rich off the proceeds of their labour. There is another way, Chopra argues. The biggest lesson I've learned over the last 5 years is that all of this is possible, he wrote in a series of tweets in response to my January article on ChatGPT. We can pay our workers 20 times the minimum wage and still be a sustainable organisation. It was the first I'd heard of Karaya, and my immediate instinct was scepticism. Sama had begun its life as a non-profit focused on poverty eradication, only to transition later to a for-profit business. Could Karaya really be a model for a more inclusive and ethical artificial intelligence industry? Even if it were, could it scale? One thing was clear, there could be fewer better testing grounds for these questions than India, a country where mobile data is among the cheapest in the world, and where it is common for even poor rural villages to have access to both a smartphone and a bank account. Then there is the potential upside. Even before the pandemic, some 140 million people in India survived on under $2.15 per day, according to the World Bank. For those people, cash injections of the magnitude Chopra was talking about could be life-changing. Just 70 miles from the bustling tech metropolis of Bengaluru, past sugarcane fields and under the bright orange arcs of blossoming Gulmohar trees, is the village of Chilakavada. Inside a low concrete building, the headquarters of a local farming cooperative, a dozen men and women are gathered, all of whom have started working for Karaya in the past week. Kanakaraj S., a skinny 21-year-old, sits cross-legged on the cool concrete floor. He is studying at a nearby college, and to pay for books and transport costs, he occasionally works as a casual labourer in the surrounding fields. A day's work can earn him 350 rupees, around $4. But this kind of manual labour is becoming more unbearable as climate change makes summers here even more sweltering than usual. Working in a factory in a nearby city would mean a slightly higher wage, but also hours of daily commuting on unreliable and expensive buses, or worse, moving away from his support network to live in dorms in the city. At Karaya, Kanakaraj can earn more in an hour than he makes in a day in the fields. The work is good, he says, and it's easy. Kanakaraj was surprised when he saw the first payment land on his bank account. We've lost a lot of money from scams, he tells me, explaining that it is common for villagers to receive SMS texts preying on their desperation, offering to multiply any deposits they make by 10. When somebody first told him about Karaya, he assumed it was a similar con, a common initial response according to Chopra. With so little in savings, local people often find themselves taking out loans to cover emergency costs. Predatory agencies tend to charge high interest rates in these loans, leaving some villagers here trapped in cycles of debt. Chandrika, for example, will use some of her Karaya wages to help her family pay off a large medical loan incurred when her 25-year-old sister fell ill with low blood pressure. Despite the medical treatment, her sister died, leaving the family responsible for both an infant and a mountain of debt. Other Karaya workers find themselves in similar situations. Ajay Kumar, 25 years old, is drowning in medical debt taken out to address his mother's severe back injury. And Shivana N., 38 years old, lost his hand in a firecracker accident as a boy. While he doesn't have debt, his disability means he struggles to make a living. The work these villagers are doing is part of a new project that Karaya is rolling out across the state of Karnataka for an Indian healthcare NGO seeking speech data about tuberculosis, a mostly curable and preventable disease that still kills around 200,000 Indians every year. The voice recordings, collected in 10 different dialects of Kannada, will help train in artificial intelligence speech model to understand local people's questions about tuberculosis and respond with information aimed at reducing the spread of the disease. The hope is that the app, when completed, will make it easier for illiterate people to access reliable information without shouldering the stigma that tuberculosis patients, victims of a contagious disease, often attract when they seek help in small communities. The recordings will go up for sale on Karaya's platform as part of its Kannada dataset, an offer to the many AI companies that care less about the contents of their training data than what it encodes about the overall structure of the language. Every time it's resold, 100% of the revenue will be distributed to the Karaya workers who contributed to the dataset, apportioned by the hours they put in. I think all of us have a keen recognition of the idea that money is a cushion from reality, Chopra says of the Karaya team. Our goal is to give that cushion to as many people as possible. Chopra knows firsthand the indignity of poverty. He was born in an informal settlement in Delhi, and although his parents were well educated from a dominant caste, they sometimes struggled to put food on the table. Chopra excelled at the local NGO-run school and won scholarships, first to a private high school in Delhi and then to Stanford, Unlike many Silicon Valley rags-to-riches stories, Chopra's trajectory in his telling wasn't down to his own hard work. I got lucky 100 times in a row, he says. I'm a product of irrational compassion from non-profits, from schools, from the government. After graduation, Chopra returned to India and joined Microsoft Research, a subsidiary of the big tech company that encourages researchers to work in difficult social problems. With his colleague Vivek Seshadri, he set out to investigate whether it would be possible to channel money to rural Indians using digital work. In 2021, with a grant from Microsoft Research, the pair quit their jobs to spin Karaya out as a non-profit, joined by a third co-founder, Safiya Hussain. Although small, Karaya already has a list of high-profile clients, including MIT, Microsoft, which holds no equity in Karaya, and Stanford. In February, Karaya began work on a new project for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to build voice datasets in five languages spoken by some 1 billion Indians: Marathi, Telugu, Hindi, Bengali, and Malayalam. The end goal is to build a chatbot that can answer rural Indians' questions in their native languages and dialects about healthcare, agriculture, sanitation, banking, and career development. This technology, think of it as a chat GPT for poverty eradication, could help share crucial knowledge across vast swaths of the subcontinent. I think there should be a world where language is no longer a barrier to technology, so everyone can use technology irrespective of the language they speak, says Kalika Bali, a linguist and principal researcher at Microsoft Research, who is working with the Gates Foundation on the project and is an unpaid member of Karaya's oversight board. She has specifically designed the prompts workers are given to read out loud to mitigate the gender biases that often creep into datasets and thus help to avoid the doctor and nurse problem. But it's not just about the prompts. Karaya's relatively high wages percolate down to the quality of the data, Bali says. It will immediately result in better accuracy of the system's output. She says she typically receives data with a less than 1% error rate from Karaya, which is almost never the case with data that we build artificial intelligence models with. Not everybody is eligible to work for Karaya. Chopra says that initially he and his team opened the app up to anybody, only to realize the first 100 signups were all men from a dominant caste community. The experience taught him that knowledge flows through the channels of power, Chopra says. To reach the poorest communities and marginalized castes, genders and religions, Chopra had to team up with non-profits with a grassroots presence in rural areas. Those organizations can distribute access codes on Karaya's behalf in line with income and diversity requirements. They know for whom that money is nice to have and for whom it is life-changing, he says. This process also ensures more diversity in the data that workers end up generating, which can help to minimize artificial intelligence bias. Chopra defines this approach using a Hindi word, Tharav, from Indian classical music that he translates as a mixture between pause and thoughtful impact. To him, it means that every step you are pausing and thinking, am I doing the right thing? Is this right for the community I'm trying to serve? It's a concept, he says, that is missing not only from the English language, but also from a lot of the entrepreneurial, move fast and break things behavior that is typical of Silicon Valley tech companies. It's an approach that has led Karaya to flatly reject 4 offers so far from prospective clients to do content moderation that would require workers to view traumatizing material. It's compelling, but it's also coming from a guy who told me he wants to scale his app to reach 100 million Indians by 2030. Doesn't Karaya's reliance on grassroots NGOs to onboard every new worker mean it faces a significant bottleneck? Actually, Chopra says the limiting factor to Karaya's expansion isn't finding new workers. There are millions who will jump at the chance to earn its high wages, and Karaya has built a vetted network of more than 200 grassroots NGOs to onboard them. The bottleneck is the amount of available work. What we need is large-scale awareness that most data companies are unethical, he says, and that there is an ethical way. For the app to have the impact Chopra believes it can, he needs to win more clients, to persuade more tech companies, governments and academic institutions to get their artificial intelligence training data from Karaya. But it's often in the pursuit of new clients that even companies that pride themselves on ethics can end up compromising. What is to stop Karaya doing the same? Part of the answer, Chopra says, lies in Karaya's corporate structure. Karaya is registered as a non-profit in the US that controls two entities in India, one non-profit and one for-profit. The for-profit is legally bound to donate any profits it makes after reimbursing workers to the non-profit, which reinvests them. The convoluted structure, Chopra says, is because Indian law prevents non-profits from making any more than 20% of their income from the market as opposed to philanthropic donations. Karaya does take grant funding. Crucially, it covers the salaries of all 24 of its full-time employees, but not enough to make an entirely non-profit model possible. The arrangement, Chopra says, has the benefit of removing any incentive for Karaya's co-founders to compromise on workers' wages or well-being in return for lucrative contracts. It's a model that works for the moment, but could collapse if philanthropic funding dries up. Karaya is very young, and they have got a lot of good traction, says Subhashari Dutta, a managing partner at the Nudge Institute, an incubator that has supported Karaya with a $20,000 grant. They have the ability to stay true to their values and still attract capital. But I don't think they have been significantly exposed to the dilemmas of taking the for-profit or not-for-profit stance. Over the course of 2 days with Karaya workers in southern Karnataka, the limitations of Karaya's current system begin to come into focus. Each worker says they have completed 1,287 tasks on the app, the maximum at the point of my visit of the number of tasks available in the tuberculosis project. It equates to about 6 hours of work. The money workers can receive just under $50 after bonuses for accuracy. It's a welcome boost, but won't last long. On my trip, I don't meet any workers who have received royalties. Chopra tells me that Karaya has only just amassed enough resellable data to be attractive to buyers. It has so far distributed $116,000 in royalties to around 4,000 workers, but the ones I've met are too early into their work to be among them. I put to Chopra that it would still take much more to have a meaningful impact on these villagers' lives. The tuberculosis project is only the beginning for these workers, he replies. They are lined up to shortly begin work on a transcription project, part of a push by the Indian government to build artificial intelligence models in several regional languages, including Kannada. The project, he says, will allow Karaya to give significantly more work to the villagers in Chilakavada. Still, the workers are a long way from the $1,500 that would mark their graduation from Karaya's system. Eventually, Chopra acknowledges that not a single one of Karaya's 30,000 workers has reached the $1,500 threshold. Yet their enjoyment of the work and their desire for more is clear. When Vivek Seshadri, Karaya's chief technology officer, asked a room full of workers whether they would feel capable of a new task flagging inaccuracies in Kannada sentences, they erupt in excited chatter, a unanimous yes. The villagers I speak to in Chilakavadi and Alahali have only a limited understanding of artificial intelligence. Chopra says this can be a challenge when explaining to workers what they're doing. The most successful approach his team has found is telling workers they are teaching the computer to speak Kannada, he says. Nobody here knows of ChatGPT, but villagers do know that Google Assistant, which they refer to as OK Google, works better when you prompt it in English than in their mother tongue. Sidharaju L., a 35-year-old unemployed father of three, says he doesn't know what AI is, but would feel proud if a computer could speak his language. The same respect I have for my parents, I have for my mother tongue. just as India was able to leapfrog the rest of the world in 4G because it was unencumbered by existing mobile data infrastructure. The hope is that efforts like the ones Karaya is enabling will help Indian language artificial intelligence projects learn from the mistakes of English artificial intelligences and begin from a far more reliable and unbiased starting point. Until not so long ago, a speech recognition engine for English would not even understand my English, says Bali, the speech researcher, referring to her accent. What is the point of AI technologies being out there if they do not cater to the users they are targeting? End of article. We have come to the halfway point of our program. You are listening to Time Magazine on Sight Into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight Into Sound channel on HD4 or 88.7 KUHF, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as Amazon Alexa and Google Home devices. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight Into Sound Radio since 1967. Our next article is titled The Boiling Point. Extreme heat is endangering America's workers and its economy. Written by Aaron Baker in Georgia. 7 a.m. Copeland Farms, Rochelle, Georgia. Just after dawn on a recent July day in Rochelle, Georgia, Sylvia Moreno Ayala steps into a pair of sturdy work pants, slips on a long-sleeve shirt, and slathers her face and hands with sunscreen. She drapes a flowered scarf over her wide-brimmed hat to protect her neck and back from the punishing rays of the sun. There isn't much she can do about the humidity, however. Morning is supposed to be the coolest part of the day, but sweat is already pooling in her rubber boots. She drinks deeply from a plastic water bottle, then squeezes out the air until it is flattened enough to tuck it into her back pocket, so she can keep her hands free while working the fields. On some days, it might be hours before she makes it back to the drinks-filled cooler that Moreno, a 41-year-old farm worker who came to the US from Mexico as a teen, has left at the field's edge. And she's heard the horror stories of farm workers dying because they didn't stay hydrated. Moreno accepts headaches, nausea, muscle cramps and dizzy spells, signs of severe heat stress, as an inevitable part of her summer workday. But by sipping a little tepid water as she goes, she hopes to stave off a worse outcome. I know people who work watermelons and get so hot they end up in the hospital, she says. Her doctor warns that she might too one day. He says her kidneys, already damaged by years of working in hot conditions, won't be able to take much more. Dozens of workers have already likely died from heat exposure this year, shaping up to be the hottest in US history. The death toll started on New Year's Day in Florida, when a 28-year-old laborer working on a bell pepper farm died from heat stroke. On June 16th, with temperatures hovering around 100 degrees Fahrenheit, construction worker Felipe Pascual overheated and died at his work site near Houston. On June 19th, a 35-year-old power lineman in East Texas succumbed to heat exposure on a 96-degree Fahrenheit day. A day later, 66-year-old postal worker Eugene Gates Jr. died making his rounds in Dallas. While a cause of death has yet to be determined, temperatures that day reached 115 degrees Fahrenheit. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, nearly 40 workers die every year from heat, most in outdoor jobs like farming, construction and package delivery. But the official statistics don't tell the real story, says Doug Parker, director of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA. We're confident that's an undercount, probably a significant undercount, largely because the role of heat is often overlooked in death certificates for cardiac arrest and respiratory failure. Public Citizen, a DC-based advocacy group, estimates extreme heat contributes to between 600 and 2,000 deaths a year, along with 170,000 injuries. Climate change is supercharging the problem. At least a third of the US population was under an extreme heat advisory at some point this summer, and next summer is likely to be worse, as the warming El Niño weather cycle intensifies throughout the winter. While the past 8 years have been the hottest in history, they are also likely to be the coolest of the next century. On a planet 5 degrees warmer, or a current end-of-century trajectory, 33 times as many people would be subjected to dangerously high levels of extreme or humid heat. But no matter how hot it gets, garbage still must be collected, packages delivered, houses roofed, roads constructed, and produce plucked for grocery store shelves. A 2020 study found that the average US farm worker already endures dangerous levels of heat for 21 days of the year. By 2050, that number could jump to 39, and by the end of the century to 62. In most states, you can be fined for leaving a dog outside without water or shade. But outside of California, Oregon, Washington, and Colorado, agricultural workers don't have the same protections. Nor do roofers, road construction crews, delivery drivers, or garbage collectors, or almost any other outdoor workers. With the risk to some 50 million Americans comes an estimated $100 billion in lost productivity, increased workers' comp premiums, lawsuits, and healthcare costs. Protecting outdoor workers from extreme heat is easy, and in most cases inexpensive. Public Citizen estimates that requiring employers to provide workers with cool water and periodic shaded rest breaks could prevent at least 50,000 injuries and illnesses a year. In 2021, President Joe Biden asked OSHA to draft a federal protocol that would do just that. But OSHA rulemaking is slow, and meanwhile opposition is ramping up, led by industry groups that hold that heat protections are too onerous, a burden for business. 9 a.m. UPS sorting facility, Rome, Georgia. By 9 a.m, some 90,000 UPS drivers across the country roll out of distribution centers in their iconic brown trucks, ready to transport the clothes, books, frozen fish, furniture, toilet paper, medicines, and overnight mail Americans depend on. The trucks, primed for efficiency and easy maintenance, are neither air-conditioned nor insulated. Working all day in heat like this is physically painful, says driver Barclay Wimpy, as he pulls his truck out of the lot in a recent 92-degree Fahrenheit morning. Unlike farm workers, drivers can't take advantage of the pre-dawn cool. Deliveries must be made during working hours. By the time we get going, the sun is already blazing, says Wimpy, 28 years old. I'm sweating before I leave the parking lot. Larry McBride, a 46-year-old UPS driver based in Phoenix, keeps a thermometer in the back of his van. Some days the temperature exceeds 135 degrees Fahrenheit. Drivers spend most of the time in those sweltering holds, shifting and selecting the packages they need for delivery. Before you realize it, you start getting disoriented, lightheaded, like you might even pass out, he says. When you step outside, even if it's 115 degrees out, you will feel like you got blasted with AC because it's so hot back there. Last summer, McBride and Wimpy both succumbed to heat exhaustion while making their rounds, and both ended up in the hospital with acute kidney injury. According to company records submitted to OSHA, at least a dozen UPS workers are hospitalized for heat-related injuries every year. Not all survive. On June 25, 2022, Esteban Chavez, 24 years old, died of suspected heat stroke while delivering packages on a 95-degree day in Pasadena, California, a tragedy that renewed calls for air conditioning the fleet. Doing so, said company spokespeople at the time, was impractical given that drivers were constantly jumping in and out of the vehicles to make their deliveries. On June 16, 2023, UPS's 340,000 Teamsters Union members voted to strike starting August 1st. In the final stages of contract negotiations, the company had agreed to air condition all new vehicles starting in 2024. McBride says the bigger issue is the relentless pace. Drivers are expected to deliver between 150 and 300 packages a day, and their progress is monitored by dashboard-mounted cameras. We need more breaks, he says. Drivers are doing 10, 12-hour days in extreme heat. That is too much for a body to take. It accumulates over time, and you can't recover. That's when things go wrong. 11 a.m. Residential Roofing Project, Macon, Georgia. By 11 a.m., George Guzman has turned off his blowtorch, stowed his tools and called the team off the roofing project they've been working on since dawn. They will pick up again at 4 p.m. when the worst of the sun's heat has burned away. By taking a break during the hottest part of the day, Guzman can let his body recover. He used to be employed at a company that worked its crews through the day, no matter the temperature. To him, it wasn't worth the risk. He started his own roofing business instead, with a small crew and one simple rule. They work hard, but on hot days they don't work stupid. It's not all about making money, it's about protecting people too, he says. A 90-degree Fahrenheit day might be perfect for the beach, but once you start working, your metabolism ramps up, burning fuel and raising the body's core temperature. Your heart compensates by pumping blood away from your overheated organs to your skin, where dilating blood vessels can dissipate the heat with the help of evaporating sweat. If it's humid and the sweat can't evaporate, the process breaks down. That's why standard temperature measurement is less important than wet bulb globe temperature, which combines thermometer readings with humidity levels, the effects of sun angle, cloud cover and wind factor. According to research led by Andreas Flouris of the University of Thessaly's FAME lab, workers can handle up to 89.7 degrees Fahrenheit to 100 degrees Fahrenheit with 30% humidity, or 86 degrees Fahrenheit with 95% humidity, as long as they are given adequate rest periods and the opportunity to replace electrolytes and liquids lost to perspiration. If not, they can suffer heat exhaustion, leading to nausea or dizziness, and may start dropping tools, stumbling off a ladder, or driving erratically. Over time, it can lead to chronic health problems as key organs such as the heart and kidneys are damaged. Heat stroke happens when the body's core temperature surpasses 104 degrees Fahrenheit, and it can no longer cool itself because sweating can cease as basic functions shut down. If that worker isn't immediately taken to a cool location and given a chance to rehydrate, death comes within a few hours. That's likely what happened to 29-year-old farm worker Efren Lopez Garcia, whose body was discovered under a tree by co-workers on July 6, 2023 in Homestead, Florida. The WBGT that day reached 92 degrees Fahrenheit, more than 2 degrees above what the body can safely tolerate. It was also the planet's hottest day in recorded history, based on a global temperature average. When concentrated among the poor and migrants, the deaths and injuries can seem to carry less weight. In some ways, they are seen as implements of the harvest, not human beings, says Dean Flores, a former California state senator who successfully launched a state heat protection standard in 2005. Everybody just kind of says, well, they're immigrants. They know the conditions that they're walking into. 1 p.m. Wood Farms Watermelon Field, Rochelle, Georgia. After a long morning picking watermelon in the sun, Victor Manuel Montes Yasso and Jesus Lopez Damian seek out the shade, where they scarf down a quick lunch of pinto beans and chicken pasta. They are both grateful for the break and dreading its end. It's always risky, says Lopez. The reality is that you have to kill yourself in the sun and the heat. Gulping down a 2-liter soda bottle, Montes nods in agreement. But you need to work, right? That's why we came here, to work hard. From the cab of his air-conditioned tractor, Billy Emery can hardly feel the heat and humidity. A work crew supervisor for Wood Farms, he is overseeing a chain of men tossing giant green melons, fireman style, from the field and ultimately through the windows of a converted school bus. Even from a distance, he can make out the sweat soaking through their clothes. He shakes his head in admiration. These guys, they can take the heat. We sure can't. Latinos make up 18% of the American workforce, but according to the United Farm Workers Union, 65% of the country's 2.6 million farm laborers, one of the most dangerous jobs when it comes to heat exposure. According to a 2022 study, agricultural workers are 35 times as likely as other workers to die of heat, which Juanita Constable, senior climate and health advocate at the Natural Resources Defense Council, attributes to indifference, a lack of protections, and a pernicious myth that people of colour are better with heat. There's often a perception that people from hot countries can deal with hot temperatures. It's just simply untrue. It's a racist belief that underpins slavery that we still see in our agricultural system now. In reality, they can take the heat, in Emery's words, only because poverty and circumstances don't give them a choice. Employers are required under OSHA rules to protect workers from hazardous conditions, but many farm labourers are scared to speak up because they are either undocumented or on H2A temporary visas and can be deported if they are fired. These workers tolerate a lot of bad conditions because they don't have a lot of options, said Solomar Spencer, director of the Farm Worker Rights Division at the non-profit Georgia Legal Services Program. As long as they're getting paid something, they're probably not going to complain about the excessive heat. One recent study found that migrants from lower-income countries faced an 80% higher risk of dangerous occupational heat strain in agricultural work compared with native employees. Absent oversight, Constable warns, as heat increases, so will the human toll of opportunistic exploitation. 3 p.m. El Paso Tienda Mexicana, Cordell, Georgia. The shelves of El Paso Tienda Mexicana Minimart in the farming town of Cordell are stocked with the favours of home, peanut candies, plantain chips, dried chilies and bottled hot sauces. In the refrigerated drink section, big jugs of lemon-lime flavoured Pedialyte are stacked six deep. It's a cheaper, if less tasty, option than Gatorade. After a sweltering day in the fields and a quick hot shower, Sylvia Moreno Ayala sometimes comes here to restock her cooler with ice and Pedialyte, prepping for the next day. On the days she supervises a work crew, she makes sure they get regular breaks and finish before the peak of late afternoon heat and humidity. She keeps the crew cooler, stocked with enough water and Pedialyte to get them through the day, on her own dime. But not all crew leaders treat their workers the same. She has watched supervisors for other farms force their crews to toil straight through the afternoon until 7 or 8 p.m. The Nixon administration proposed setting up a federal heat safety standard to protect workers in 1972, not long after OSHA was established, but it never went anywhere. Such a standard would help hold employers responsible when workers die or are injured from entirely preventable causes, says Andrew Levinson, OSHA's Director of Standards and Guidance. It would also even out the playing field for employers who are trying to do the right thing for their workers. Nor would it be that onerous to implement. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has recommendations indicating how often a worker should rest and hydrate given a specific heat and humidity index, which could be the basis for new rules determining lengths and intervals of mandated paid breaks, says Julie Fulcher, Public Citizens Worker Health and Safety Advocate. Employers should be obligated to make water and shade easily accessible, says Fulcher, and a standard should include an anti-retaliation clause so workers can report violations without fear of getting fired or deported. In short, says Fulcher, a federal standard should look like the one California established in 2005. After a spate of farm worker deaths, farm owners warned at the time that the bill would increase costs and that consumer prices would spike as a result. But you know what? I haven't seen a decline in productivity since, says former Senator Flores. In fact, the California ag industry seems to be on an upswing. It's pretty clear that protecting workers is good for business. Washington State was the next to adopt heat protection standards. In 2008, followed by Colorado and Oregon. Since then, efforts to protect workers elsewhere have been largely stalled. A New York State bill, which would require businesses to protect outdoor workers into air-conditioned trucks in all the indoor workplaces in certain industries, is languishing in committee. In Nevada, a proposal to require water, rest and shade for employees once temperatures exceed 95 degrees was eventually amended to 105 degrees Fahrenheit and still failed. Virginia State Workplace Safety Board voted against a proposal to adopt a heat illness prevention rule in 2021. In the middle of a three-week heat wave that broke all temperature records, Texas passed a law that effectively eliminated water breaks for construction workers in Austin and Dallas. A federal standard would, of course, apply nationwide. The prospect galvanizes the opposition. After OSHA opened the floor to public comments in 2021, industry lobby groups objected. The American Farm Bureau Federation said it appears unnecessary and proposed that OSHA partner with employers on better training materials instead. The National Cotton Council argued that heat injuries weren't due to the work itself, but rather to present-day luxuries such as air conditioning, making it more difficult for workers to face a severe change in temperature, and younger workers who are used to a more sedentary lifestyle. According to Pam Knox, the director of the University of Georgia Weather Network and an agricultural climatologist, there are legitimate concerns about cost as well. It's going to be a struggle for farmers to take care of the workforce, she says, while also dealing with the challenges of unpredictable weather extremes brought on by climate change. Farmers work in very tight margins. If you have to give your workers more frequent work breaks, you have to pay them for extra hours. If workers don't get breaks, they die. And that costs you money too, retorts Fulcher. It's not just heat stroke deaths, but also injuries and accidents, which can drive up insurance fees and legal costs. According to Flowers of the FAME Lab, heat stress and dehydration can impair decision-making and increase risk-taking, while decreasing cognitive function. For an outdoor worker climbing a ladder, wielding a chainsaw, or sitting behind the wheel of a 10-ton delivery vehicle, a minor episode of heat stress-derived dizziness can turn into a major disaster. I just don't know how anybody could sit there and argue that a safety thing would increase your cost, says James Lanier, the managing partner for waste management company Ryland Environmental, who has implemented a stringent heat safety plan to protect his 200 employees. If you look at the cost of implementation versus what one accident would cost you if you did have one, it is very, very, very negligible. California saw a 30% decline in worker injuries after passing its heat bill, and all it takes is spending a day mowing the lawn in the hot sun to realize that heat can be a productivity killer. What I say to the people who say that compliance costs are too high is that you're probably losing money right now, says Constable, and you just don't realize it. 5 p.m. Ryland Waste Management Depot, Macon, Georgia. When 5 p.m. rolls around, Chris Powell is ready to clock out. He's been hanging off the back of a garbage truck for most of the past 10 hours, and his arms are slicked with sweat in the 91-degree afternoon heat. His job wrestling full garbage cans into the embrace of the truck's mechanical arm is taxing, but manageable. Lanier, his boss, forces everyone to take at least 2 15-minute pauses during the day in the air-conditioned cool of the garbage truck's front cab, in addition to a regular lunch break. Paul is well-versed in heat stress symptoms and treatment. It's the principal topic of his weekly paid safety training these days. Though he's never found it too hot to work, if he felt unwell, he says he's confident that Ryland would call the truck back to base. But eventually he'd be sent out again. Garbage collection is essential, says his supervisor, Maurice Dillard. Regardless of whether it's 112 degrees Fahrenheit or 120 degrees or 54 degrees outside, it just has to be done. Lanier says that if the Georgia heat ever got as bad as some climate projections suggest, he would consider adding more breaks or rejiggering the pickup schedule for cooler parts of the day. I don't want to ever have to make that call to somebody's family to say, hey, somebody's had an issue. They're in hospital, or God forbid, even worse. Lanier says he welcomes the idea of a federal heat protection standard, though he doesn't think it will change anything he's already doing. If other employers complain of government meddling, he has a simple answer. Well then, do the right thing. Care about your employees. 9 a.m. Phoenix, Tulsa, Baton Rouge, Jackson, Laredo, Key West, Las Vegas, Bakersfield, Memphis, Macon, and dozens of other U.S. cities. By 9 a.m. the next day, temperatures from California to Florida are approaching 100 degrees Fahrenheit, sparking extreme heat advisories for nearly a third of the American population. Public health officials are urging residents to drink water, stay indoors and avoid outdoor exercise. But farmhands in Florida, road construction crews in Texas, and delivery drivers in Phoenix are hard at work, keeping America running under life-threatening conditions. Legally, they have no choice. Why are we being asked to choose between working and staying alive? Asked UPS driver Larry McBride as he takes a photo of the temperature reading from the back of his truck. It shows 137 degrees Fahrenheit. This is just going to continue where we are dropping like flies. End of article. Next, we turn to our time off section of the magazine. The 100 best movies of the past 10 decades. There's no right or wrong in movie love. If you're like most people, you probably freeze when somebody asks you what you think is the best movie of all time. What if you give a confident answer, only to wake up in the middle of the night, certain you should have said something else? And do you choose the movie you love most, or one you know is commonly identified as great? After all, if you go with one of the classic default choices, Citizen Kane, Casablanca, The Godfather, no one can accuse you of having bad taste or strange taste or the wrong taste. After compiling and annotating my own list of the 100 best movies of the past century, broken down by decade, 10 pictures in each, I'm here to reassure you that there's no such thing as the wrong taste. And if there is such a thing as bad or strange taste, then my advice is to own it. No one can dictate your preferences to you. They're as individual as your fingerprints. Besides, the issue is further complicated by the fact that there are so many barometers of greatness. Is the best movie the one you can watch any time? The one that always lifts your mood? Is it the one that makes you cry the hardest? Is it the one with the actors you never tire of watching? Your decisions about what constitutes greatness will be specific to you. In this case, I'm giving you mine. The internet is full of polls that have divined, by soliciting votes from film critics and filmmakers, what are ostensibly the greatest movies of all time. This list isn't the result of a poll. Aside from the question of whether we really need yet another film survey, there's a way in which choosing by committee irons the idea of loving movies into a smooth, flat sheet, as if the right amount of number crunching will yield the answer. But as with all individuals, our sensibilities are much more nuanced. There is no such thing as an objective truth when it comes to art. Our movie tastes are determined by some indefinable electrical current of enthusiasm or joy or deep radiating sadness or some combination of the three. In that sense, our favourite movies aren't about taste at all, but simply about listening to what really speaks to us. So how did I choose these 100 films? I've spent more than 50 years choosing. These are movies that entwine craftsmanship and spirit. They often feature striking performances. For whatever reason, they touch me deeply. And all speak in some way about the era in which they were made. They're place markers for the things we've seen and the places we've been, and the experiences of our forebears. Or more accurately, some of our forebears. The unfortunate truth is that through most of the 20th century, the world of filmmaking belonged to white men, at least behind the camera. Women flexed their power with great performances, many of which are reflected in this list. There were certainly women filmmakers working in the early part of the century. Alice Guy Blaché, Dorothy Arzner, Ida Lupino. But until the 1960s and 70s at least, the barriers to entry were high. The same is true for filmmakers of colour, particularly in the US. Through much of the 20th century, it was easier for black artists to make their mark in music, literature and painting than in movies. There are exceptions. There was a flowering of so-called race films in the early part of the century, films made specifically for black American audiences. The novelist and filmmaker Oscar Michaud was an early successful pioneer. But it would be decades before filmmakers like Charles Burnett, Melvin Van Peebles, and Julie Dash would find a footing. In that sense, one component of the past 100 years of cinema is a blank space filled with unrealized possibilities. American history is filled with such blank spaces, and they say a lot about us. We have come to the end of our program. I have been reading Time Magazine. My name is Angus McVicar, and this has been a production of Sight Into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas, since 1967.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction. And those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.